We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Maria, now you've been back for a whole week. We just milk that further. All right, let's start out with
that means I'm going to be gone next week.
Oh, it could be. That's the first I'm hearing about it.
Thanks for letting me know, John.
Sure.
Let's start out with local and light rail decisions happening regionally.
Yeah, this week the Bellevue City Council voted 4-3 on the preferred alignment for light rail through up to downtown Bellevue and through downtown Bellevue. And what's interesting is that their preferred route doesn't correspond even remotely to the options that Sound Transit gave them to vote on. The Bellevue City Council, by a narrow majority, decided that they want light rail to go along I-90 and then along the BNSF rail line, which runs right on the edge of Mercer Slough. Now, the Sound Transit options, none of them included running light rail along I-90, and Sound Transit has often said that they are not willing to do that. That's not their preferred alternative.
Because there aren't any people there.
Right. Their preferred alternative is along 520 through population centers, and Sound Transit wants to run light rail along 112th Avenue Southeast. And not only is it because there will be more riders there, but there are also more stable soils. They're looking at Mercer Slough and going, God, that could be a nightmare. It could raise the costs by over $100 million. Of course, Bellevue, Sound Transit has given into Bellevue's preferred downtown alignment of a tunnel, and they're basically saying to the Bellevue City Council, look, go back to the drawing board on this because, you know, we're already spending more for a tunnel. We can't spend even more to run this thing in an area that's going to massively cut down on the number of riders who are going to use it. And, of course, this shows, too, that the Bellevue business leaders and their representatives on the city council really look at light rail not as a transit option, as a local transit option, but as some kind of regional people mover thing that doesn't really connect to anything besides a few park and rides here and there along some freeways. That's not what rail is good for. It's not what rail is meant for. If you go to any of the cities, like I was talking about last week, Chicago, Vancouver, you know, San Francisco,
Portland,
any of the cities that have functioning rail lines, you see that it is not used as a regional transport system. You're not, you know, shipping people from one park and ride to another. It's used as a local transit option. You're moving people from neighborhood to neighborhood, from population center to population center. And what really kills me is, you know, 150 more years ago when we were building a major railway system throughout the United States to link up the cities in the continental U.S., towns would fight over who got a railway station because they knew that having the rail line, a passenger rail line, made them a destination. And in cities where you have rail lines, they really do promote it to the tourists as a great way to get around the city, see the neighborhoods, you know, view the destinations on the rail line. And the fact that business leaders and that the Bellevue City Council and local politicians can't get that into their head really proves how ignorant they are.
Yeah, they haven't
what transit can do for
them. They haven't caught up with the mid-19th century yet.
I know. It's just amazing to
me. The other thing that rail is good for in terms of rail development and why you've seen such a boom in light rail building in cities across the country is that political leaders have discovered that it's a great tool for real estate development. And, you know, given that the city of Bellevue is and has for many years been run by essentially, you know,
real estate developers, the
Kemper Freeman, you know, model of real estate huckster, it really is staggering that they don't have any realization that one of the benefits of siting a station somewhere is that it creates a cluster. It creates what in Seattle will be called an urban village because, you know, you wind up getting an enormous amount of development within walking distance of that railway station, both in terms of high-rise living facilities and in terms of neighborhood amenities. That's not going to be possible if you stick the rail station out in the middle of nowhere where you can't where you don't have the soil possible and you don't have the street access possible to develop things around it. So it really is extraordinarily short-sighted on behalf of Bellevue.
Yeah, and it really, I think, proves how out of touch the Bellevue City Council is with even their own, you know, real constituents, the population of Bellevue, because, here in the city of Seattle, all of the planning for Sound Transit, neighborhoods come to the city to Sound Transit and they say, you know, we would like a rail station in our neighborhood. We've seen that in with the planning of the North Line, attempts to run the North Line up the freeway or up other city streets that where there weren't neighborhoods have been protested by particularly like I'm thinking in particular the neighborhood around Roosevelt and Ravenna area where they've said, you know, we want station in the neighborhood because we view it as a way for people to get to and from work as something that is going to enhance the neighborhood. We don't want it over there at the park and ride next to the freeway. That doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on, an update on Referendum 71.
Yeah, U.S. District Judge Benjamin Settle dismissed a motion from Protect Marriage Washington. That's the anti-gay religious group that backed the referendum protesting equal rights for non-heterosexual couples. That motion would have been a reconsideration of their amended lawsuit that was dismissed by the U.S. Supreme Court a few months ago. What all of that means is that the effort by Referendum 71's backers to prevent people from knowing who signed their petition to get that measure on the ballot is likely dead unless they refile the motion somehow. So that legal saga continues. It wasn't dismissed with prejudice, so they can refile it again, but the onus now is on the backers of the lawsuit to if they want to try and drag this through some more steps of court, but it doesn't look like they would be very successful if they do.
All right. Okay, moving on to national and the climate bill.
Yeah, last year the House passed a climate bill that included some caps on carbon, on greenhouse gas emissions, and then it was in the Senate's court to pass a similar bill. And at first, a similar bill was introduced in the Senate, but then it got watered down by taking out all of the caps for everything but power plant emissions, and then it got further watered down, removing all caps, and then this week it was dead on arrival. The Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid basically admitted, well, we're not going to get a climate bill passed this year if at least before the elections.
Yeah, and you knew that was not going to happen simply because of the dysfunctionality of the Senate, that with the united opposition of the Republican Party to essentially anything that Democrats try to do, all it takes is a handful of Democrats to prevent a bill from passing. And there are just enough Democrats that come from energy-producing states like, the West Virginia and Kentucky and such, that although there aren't any Democrats from West Virginia, there are a couple from Kentucky, there are a couple from West Virginia, and there are other states as well that have energy sector Democrats that are critical of a bill that would limit greenhouse gases or impose any kind of a carbon tax or a cap and trade system. So what you wind up with is it makes it virtually impossible for the Senate in particular to pass any legislation dealing with critical public issues. And we've seen this over and over again where with healthcare reform, for example, the final reform bill had to be watered down so badly in order to get anything passed that it turned out to be essentially a joke.
We've seen it also with the financial reform bill.
I was going to say the Wall Street reform bill that was passed this week. Same kind of thing. This week we saw the unemployment benefits finally pass because the Democrats got a 60th senator pass with seated with the replacement for Senator Robert Byrd after his passing being seated from West Virginia this week. But it took that 60th senator because every single Republican was opposed to what used to be a pretty much bipartisan consensus thing extending unemployment benefits. So, unless you have in the next Senate, which will almost certainly have more Republicans than the current one does, unless you have some sort of an abolition of the filibuster rule, which is in some ways playing with fire, you're going to see complete paralysis for the next couple of years, which comes at a very, very bad time in the history of our country, given the kind of critical problems that we're facing. But if you do abolish the filibuster rule, what you're going to get instead of these wild swings as the Senate passes in control from one party to the other and back, because they are so far apart on how to handle or not handle these major problems.
Well, perhaps complete paralysis is what the body politic needs. You know, the kind of way they put someone into a coma when they're so out of it that, you know, so they can heal. So
I just wish I could see more signs of healing going on.
Yeah. All right. Or even a concern that something ought to be healed.
Yeah. Yeah. Although, you know, that's not a bad analogy, because a lot of people are doing things on a local level in terms of climate change that are very promising. And it may be that if you can put the federal government in a paralysis to give the local governments and local grassroots initiatives time to get up speed and to you know, become a national movement, that might be a good thing. You never know.
Yeah, the problem is that the federal government, it's an economy of scale issue, where the federal government has so much influence on the economy and so much influence on how the private sector does business that without action on their behalf, you know, it's like talking about we're going to curtail our home water usage when Boeing is down the street you know, 60 gazillion times as much water.
Or the state of Washington is going to do something when you've got California south of us and Texas and New York not following suit.
Yeah, exactly. It's a sort of thing where the federal government really has to take issue on a lot of these things. And then there's also the issue of standardization, where it may be fine and well for Washington and California to do something, but Texas is not going to be doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to get on the, we need to get on the same page in order to have solutions for these things.
Right, right.
All right. Well, moving to a example of a local solution, Oakland supporting farmers.
Oh, yeah. The city of Oakland is considering issuing
when
permits.
When I think of agriculture.
Yeah, you don't necessarily think of industrial-sized marijuana farms, but the city of Oakland is considering legalizing and issuing permits for industrial-sized marijuana farms. And, of course, in that process, they would be charging fees and taxes. For the city of Oakland, they see this as a big revenue generator. They currently have a $31 million hole in their city budget, and they ran the figure. And they decided, well, you know, because medical marijuana is legal in California and California state law doesn't really provide for how the pot's going to be grown, you know, they only provide for how much, you know, people can have at any one time and how they can get it.
And there's a ballot measure for full decriminalization on
the
ballot.
There's a ballot measure that California voters will vote on in November that could legalize marijuana for recreational consumption. Oakland's looking ahead and saying, you know, we can get ahead of this and be the leader in providing, you know, space for providing the space and the legal structure for marijuana farms to exist in our city. And they ran the numbers and they figured out that they could make up to $38 million a year by permitting and taxing these industrial sized farms. Of course, there's a flip side of this too. A lot of the current growers are probably looking at this going, well, you know, once you legalize marijuana, it kind of invites in corporate agriculture to take it over, which can be a bad thing for people who have been growing and perfecting strains and trying to market and sell their product for decades now.
GMO pot.
GMO pot. Yeah, imagine that. That would be terrible.
All right. Moving on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, speaking of GMO, there's a GM, General Motors, decided this week that they were going to get back in the finance business. Now, back in 2007, when GM was struggling, they were forced to sell GMAC, their finance arm, which provided loans to customers who wanted to buy GM cars and trucks. Well, and of course, when the balance sheet was looked at, it turned out that GMAC and all of the loans that they issued to low income or people with bad credit really had dragged the company down. And of course, U.S. taxpayers were forced to step in and bail it out by offering up some $43 billion to get a majority of stock in GM. So taxpayers now own about 61% of the company. Were the majority shareholders in GM? Well, the GM management is deciding that they want to buy a finance unit again. They want to buy AmeriCredit, and they're going to pay $3.5 billion for AmeriCredit. In other words, they're directly taking cash that taxpayers gave to GM, and they're turning it around to buy a unit that would get them into further trouble. AmeriCredit, I want to point out, makes loans to people with low credit ratings. Yes, that's right. AmeriCredit is a subprime lender, exactly the sort of thing that GM should not own. Now, GM currently has $30 billion in cash reserves. That's why they can afford to buy AmeriCredit. And what I want to ask is, look, if you guys have $30 billion in cash reserves, when are you going to pay back the taxpayers? You know, you owe us $43 billion plus interest. Start paying it back, buddies. Don't start buying something that's going to get you into further trouble. But really, this is sort of emblematic of what's happening, not just in the auto industry, but on Wall Street in general. There's been a lot of news about record profits in companies like Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, et cetera, and paying out big bonuses again. It just means that those folks who are saying that the bailout of Wall Street actually saved the economy, what really happened is the bailout of Wall Street allowed big Wall Street banks and finance companies and the auto industry to go back to business as usual. That is not good news.
No, and particularly since we mentioned the financial reforms that were signed this week, as Maria was explaining last week, those explicitly excepted the auto companies from any kind of consumer oversight
in order of their lending processes.
So then GM can turn around and they as soon as that passes, they then turn around and buy a company that specializes in high risk loans.
Yeah.
From people who are most likely to be defrauded. What does that tell you?
Yeah, that is not good news. Oh, and I want to point out, too, some interesting statistics about GM. GM sales in the U.S. have been shrinking, of course. People know that, falling by about 30% in 2008 and 2009. But at the same time, their sales in China have been surging by about 67% a year. They are now the largest supplier to the Chinese market of cars and trucks. They have a 13% share in the Chinese market. There are a lot of automakers in China, which is why 13% gives them a majority of the market share. But that also shows there's a lot of room for growth. And GM is expecting, and for the first time last year, GM sold more cars in China than they did in the United States. So that has some that's going to have some interesting impacts on the environment as well as on a U.S. business. But I find that interesting that U.S. taxpayers, who own a majority of the company, are really subsidizing car sales to China.
Is any of this coming up at our shareholder meeting for our GM stocks? When is that again? I didn't get that in the mail yet.
Right.
So. All right. Moving on. Big media spectacle this week over the firing of Shirley Sherrod.
Yeah. Shirley Sherrod, a mid-level USDA employee in Georgia who nobody knew the name of a week ago. Well, now we all do, thanks to a media hoax perfpetrated by Andrew Breitbart, the same conservative media clown who brought us the Doctored Acorn video, surfaced again on Fox News this week with a video that had Sherrod describing to an NAACP audience how she refused help to a white farmer because they were white. And the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, promptly fired her. And then it came out within 24 hours that the video had been doctored completely out of context, that she was using the story to describe how she had a change of heart because she, even though her father had been killed by white Klansmen in rural Georgia back in the days of Jim Crow, that she realized that it shouldn't be about race and went back back and helped out the farmer, and they became lifelong friends and helped save the family farm and yada, 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 and used this as a way of illustrating that people really need to unite, particularly around issues of class, and that what separates us in terms of skin color really shouldn't separate us at all. So something that turned out to be a really heartwarming story about overcoming racism was used purportedly to prove exactly the opposite, namely those nasty black racists. So that, unfortunately, you expect that out of Fox News, and you expect that out of somebody like Andrew Breitbart. What you don't expect is that mainstream media would unquestionably accept it, even knowing the source, even knowing the history of a manipulation of video in the Acorn.
Or that an Obama administration official.
Well, I'm getting to that.
Yeah, would accept it unquestioningly.
Or that their bosses at the Department of Agriculture and the USDA and the White House, because apparently there were a number of frenzied calls from the White House to the Department of Agriculture saying you got to get rid of this one, to the extent where they had Sherrod literally pull over while she was bribing and text in her resignation on her BlackBerry because they couldn't wait for her to get to a place where she'd actually, you know, get to a computer. It really is appalling that they didn't bother to ask for, nor were they interested in Sherrod's version of the story or seeking out the original video or doing any other kind of due diligence on this story before seeing it as a form of damage control where we see the political fallout from this. We got to get rid of her regardless of whether it's true or not. So at this point, they've apologized. They may or may not offer her her job back. She may or may not get it. But it really underscores once again, a narrative that even though Breitbart was discredited by a lot of this, although certainly not in the right wing echo chamber where he's continually being hailed by as a hero by a lot of conservatives. They really did win because, you know, for one thing, on a week when they passed the Wall Street reform and the unemployment benefits, and the Obama administration should have been crowing about all of this because they see it anyway as an accomplishment. Instead, they were talking about this. And instead, they were talking about race and reminding people that the president of the United States is black, heaven forbid. And instead, they got the Obama administration, I almost said the Bush administration, to show once again that it has no spine, that it is not willing to stand up for what it believes. And this is a narrative of the Democratic Party that has plagued it for decades, really, but certainly going through the triangulation of the Clinton years and knowing the Obama years as well, and certainly with the lack of opposition to a lot of the Bush-era initiatives of the Republicans, that one of the biggest frustrations of the public with the Democratic Party is they don't go to the mat for what they believe in. And we're seeing this also with the frustration over Congress, where even though you have 59 Democrats in the Senate, now 60, and even though you have an overwhelming majority in the House, they still can't get things passed because they don't push hard enough for them, or because they make concessions on negotiations before the negotiations even begin. So it really did underscore a very destructive narrative for the Democrats, and they walked right into it. They did it once again, and the fact that they treated this woman terribly unfairly is just a reminder once again that they don't have your back, and they don't have any of our backs.
All right. Moving on to international, beginning with Indonesia.
Yeah, the U.S., the White House and the U.S. State Department decided to lift the ban on training and funding Kopassus. That's the Indonesian Special Forces. There's about 5,000 members of the Indonesian Special Forces. Folks who have been paying attention to Southeast Asia news for years know that Kopassus is notorious, that the Indonesian Special Forces has been accused and proven to have engaged in human rights abuses in East Timor prior to their election for independence. And I believe that was in 2002 in Aceh province just within the past decade. Yeah. And most recently in Papua, where they have been accused of killing a lot of human rights and social justice activists in Papua. Nevertheless, even though Congress had imposed a ban on U.S. training and support for any military units involved in human rights abuses, and that included COPASIS, and that ban went into effect in 1999, Congress had no say at all in lifting the ban this week against COPASIS. It was the White House who caved in because the Pentagon has been leaning on them for years in order to provide training and funding to the Indonesian government because they're now viewed as a major ally in the war on terror. In addition, the Indonesian government decided to ratchet up the request by making hints that they were going to go to China for help if the U.S. didn't step in. And so, of course, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. And the Obama administration said, oh, no, please don't go to China. Come to us. We're going to lift the ban.
Yes, because of course, if they go to China, that means they might start borrowing weapons from China as well. And we can't have that.
Yeah. So, you know, don't go to another human rights abuser in your neighborhood like China. Come to us. We'll help you do that.
Yeah, we'll help you abuse human rights instead.
We'll help you kill activists. Yes.
All right. Well, speaking of China, talk about that in the International Energy Agency.
Yeah, more news on China this week. The International Energy Agency said that last year China overtook the U.S. for the first time in total energy consumption. That means China is now the world's leader in consumption of energy resources. The U.S. still has a higher per capita consumption. That means a per person consumption. But
per capita, it's still about four times as much because China has more than four times the U.S.'s population.
Yes, yes. And China's population has an average lower living standard, but that's not going to be happening for long because we see that living standard increasing all the time.
And we see ours decreasing all the time.
Yeah. What's interesting about this is that there's some consequences to this, obviously, for the environment. China, like here in the U.S., their major source of energy for their power plants is the burning of coal. And they are one of the largest consumers of coal. They overtook Japan in purchases of coal last year. And China also, on the other hand, is a world leader in the development of solar and wind power, which they, of course, view as only a small part of their total energy needs. And last year, for the first time, China became the largest purchaser of oil from Saudi Arabia. So we are no longer the leading client for Saudi Arabia. So this will also have some interesting economic and geopolitical consequences, too. If you think about it, because the U.S. is no longer the leader in energy consumption, we can no longer determine the types of energy that will be developed and used worldwide. It's China that's going to determine that. We will no longer be the country that determines which nations are rewarded with our energy dollars. China is the one who will determine which nations are going to be the leading suppliers to the world for energy resources. And although the U.S. hasn't had a great record in supporting governments with good human rights records in that regard, China won't be any better or probably any worse. We will no longer have that potential influence.
Yeah, and in fact, if you want examples of the geopolitical impact of this, this is a major reason why the U.S. has been really had its hands tied in terms of trying to have any kind of influence on Iran's development of a possible nuclear weapons program.
Exactly.
Because Iran sells most of its oil to China, so they don't really have to care what we think.
China and Russia have both been the stumbling blocks there, and we recently got Russia over on our side, but we're a long ways away of getting China to agree with us in terms of sanctions against Iran. Also, I think what's very important too is that not only will it change our ability to influence the world, we might also look at, you know, how in the past did the U.S. spend money in terms of securing an energy supply. You know, we spent tons of money just this past decade in two wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, largely to secure oil supply for the United States and to prove that we control that part of the world. Well, I guess the question is now, does that impetus to spend so much money end, or are we going to go bankrupt ourselves in a last gasp to try to control oil supply for China as well as our own population?
given that that latter course of action would also put a lot of money in the hands of military contractors, I suspect I know way they're going to go.
You're guessing they're going to go for option two, the bankrupt America in order to control China's oil supply.
Exactly. Which won't work, by the way, but it will work in the sense that it'll make a lot of friends of powerful people rich.
Right.
All right. Talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State, well, we're going to be coming out. We'll be talking about this on the air in the next couple of weeks also. We're going to be coming out with our election endorsement issue for the August primary. That'll be coming out this coming week, and you can find it at bookstores and cafes and places where you find free periodicals. You can also find our ongoing publication, eatthestate.org, at, surprise, surprise, www.eatthestate.org. And check it out. Check out our blog and participate.